McGraw gets the fan, goes into the motion. Here's the two-strike pitch. Swung on, hit on the ground toward first. Milner has the ball. Looks to McGraw. It's over. The New York Mets have won the pennant. The New York Mets have won the pennant. The New York Mets have won the pennant, and this is a wild scene. Fans are pouring out onto the field. A mad scene at Shea Stadium as the New York Mets have won the National League pennant.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, January the 5th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, Talking Mets, no G. And I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Happy New Year. Hope everybody's had a great New Year. Only a few days in. Weird saying 2025. And snow in the forecast for some of you. Cold, wintry conditions here in New York. And I wish I could say the hot stove is heating us up. It's not. And I thought about today's show, and I come to you late here on a Sunday, and I want to try something different, quite simply because I think we're a little bit tired of the hot stove. We're tired of waiting for news about Pete Alonso and the rest of the offseason with the Mets. Hopefully things get cooking a little bit this upcoming week now that the holidays are over. But with a little bit of a down period when it comes to free agency, I thought it'd be a good opportunity to do something different. And during various points of the season and at times of this show, we look back at the history of Mets baseball. We used to do a lot more of it. I think we do a lot less of it. And some of that is intentional, as I know there's a group of fans that sometimes feel like these look back segments take away from conversation that a lot of people are interested in regarding the current team, whether it be during the season or hot stove or what have you. But part of what I try to do here at the Talking Mets podcast is give you an all-encompassing product when it comes to everything about the Mets. It's not just about the current team. It's about the farm system and the future and obviously history. And I've said this many, many times, learning about Mets history, whether you were around for it or not, whether it's always pertinent to today or not, is an important part of really giving the total fan experience. Now, segments like what we're going to do tonight have to be appropriately put into the flow of conversation in the news cycle. And I thought, and I thought about it long and hard with the Hall of Fame conversation coming up in a couple of weeks. I thought today was the perfect day. So joining me as a new guest of the show, he actually has his own Substack, which is not just Mets related, but he grew up a Mets fan. He is a Mets fan. And he just put together a great project. And I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation because I had a chance to catch up with him earlier today. It's Len Furman, the Sports Time Traveler. You can go to his website, thesportstimetraveler.com. He's got some other stuff there. He's also going to be teasing another project that he's doing. But he just did a project, and he wrote a book about it, the 1973 Mets, You've Gotta Believe. And I know there are other books about the 73 Mets, and I think there'll be other books coming out. But I think what Len did with this project is a little bit different. He'll get into it. He's going back to the newspaper archive and following the season on August 5th of when he wrote the book, he's reading August 5th, 1973 and following it as if he's there. He's transporting himself. So truly, he's a time traveler. On the day of what the current day is, he's going back 50 plus years and reliving what happened with the Mets that day. And I think that's a really different way of putting a book together and a project, and it's actually quite smart. It's ingenious in a lot of ways. Wish I thought of it. I didn't. I'm just here being your humble radio host. So, really cool book. You could get it over at Amazon, the 1973 Mets, You Gotta Believe, thesportstimetraveler.com. He's also got a Substack. And I think what's interesting is that there's also a foreword in the book by Ted Kubiak, who played for the Oakland A's who unfortunately won that World Series, and give some perspective. And you'll hear from Len and the perspective. We get into a whole lot of different things. We get into Willie Mays and the team and the World Series and beating the Big Red Machine. And me, as someone who was not alive when that happened, and also looking at it through a modern lens, I interject a little bit with my modern lens view of the team, and you could hear Len's rebuttal on that. So I want you to sit back, a little bit of a different Talking Mets podcast, a way to put a little cap, I guess, on what is a weird holiday week when the holidays are in the middle of the week, as we get back into the swing of things tomorrow on Monday, and we start to look. And let's face it, there's only about 6 weeks left before pitchers and catchers. We're really getting into the dog days of hot stove here. And I really think that some things are going to start moving. So this is our chance to take a little bit of a respite from the long off season on a cold winter night and look back for some of you for a season that ended poorly, but might bring up some really fun memories. And a Mets team, the 1973 Mets, that I think gets really overlooked in the course of Mets history, because they're not 69, they're not 86. A lot of the contemporary fans like myself have more an affinity to 99 and 2000. You have the modern fan who is obviously going to be more connected to the 2015 team, or maybe even 2006. So there are a bunch of teams in Mets history that didn't win a championship, only two championships. This is one of them, but they're one of the pennant winners, and I think they get lost in the shuffle a little bit. And Len Furman, the sports time traveler, is going to let us know what he thinks about them and what he learned doing this project, going back day by day, reading the newspaper and reliving the 1973 Mets. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, Len Furman, the sports time traveler, and I talk about the 1973 Mets. You've got to believe. Check it out on Amazon, the book, also thesportstimetraveler.com. We'll be back with Len Furman, the 1973 Mets, right after this.
They play Garrett, even though he's going against the fast-falling left-hander, way around to the right, still to pull the ball. And now the fans realize, instead of this World Series being over, as it should be, but for the error, one swing of the bat could tie it up. Knowles back, throws a little looper. Campanaris goes back, says, "I got it, that is it!" The Oakland A's have won their second consecutive World Series championship. The first time that's been done since the Yankees of 62 and 63. And for the first time in the last seven World Series, one league has won two in a row. And that is, of course, the American League. Charles O. Finley being led off now, carrying an Oakland pennant as he heads for the dressing room. The fans are trying to get to the dressing room, and we'll be back for some dressing room talk in just a moment, but now we pause for this message.
We're back, and always like to go on the show into the past of Mets baseball, and we don't get as much time to do it because we're all stuck in free agency, and obviously with the Hall of Fame vote coming up, maybe we'll do a little bit of that. David Wright's number getting retired later this summer, we'll probably do a little bit about that. But here on a cold winter off-season day, I have the pleasure of joining me Len Furman. Now, Len has his own newsletter, has his own website, and it just came out with a great book, and for some Mets fans, it's going to bring back a ton of memories about the 1973 Mets, you got to believe. He's also got a podcast and a Substack, The Sports Time Traveler. And we're going to get into the vault and the time machine. And Len, welcome to the program. I'll tell you what, the 1973 Mets become, in Mets lore, this forgotten season. It really is. They're not 69. They're not 86. The modern fan is always going to lean more towards 2015, or I grew up as a teenager in 99 and 2000. Everybody has a season that didn't end in a championship that's their favorite. I think this one gets overlooked, but not by you. So welcome to the program. The 1973 Mets, you got to believe. The sports time traveler, Len Furman, a great book you can get over at Amazon. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm looking forward to talking Mets with you.
Why 1973? I mean, I'm assuming you're a Mets fan. I mean, the Mets fans always seem to be history nostalgic type of people. You know, the sports time travel does more than just the Mets, but I'm just curious, why 1973? Was this something for you special about that?
Well, there is something very special for me about it. It was kind of a foundational year for me as a Mets fan. I was 9 years old. I turned 10 before the World Series in 1973, and it was kind of that perfect age where you really understand things and you can become emotionally connected to a team. The players are your heroes, and I followed this team from last place where they were mired all summer long. And summers seem so terribly long when you're a little kid. And then,
Amazing, isn't it? Like now I feel like it's okay. For me, being on the road when the schools are out, thank God the traffic gives me a break for 2 months. I wake up, it's August 1st. I'm like, oh, school's coming back in 30 days. It goes like this. I don't know what happened as we got older. It's not incredibly long at all. It's amazing. It's funny you brought that up.
then in 1973, we go back to school, and the Mets have what is really the most sensational run in baseball history. No team has ever gone from last place to first place in the final month of the season. And yet, that is what happened. The Mets passed every team in the NL East and miraculously won the division. And you mentioned the 69 team, which everybody remembers the Miracle Mets. At least 20 books have been written about them. Cleon Jones, who was one of the heroes of the 69 team, he was also on the 73 team. And he was actually quoted in the newspapers in late September 1973 saying, if we win this, it's going to be bigger than in 69, because it was so miraculous going from last to first. And it was so magical for me as a kid that I wanted to relive the experience. So when we got to 50 years last year, when we got to the 50-year anniversary of the 1973 team, I decided I'm going to go back in the sports time traveler method of doing things that I've come up with, where I read the newspaper systematically one day at a time. And I'm going to actually follow the entire 1973 season one day at a time,
Wow.
mimicking the cadence of real life. And that's
That's interesting.
what I've discovered as the sports time traveler is that's what gives you the feeling of actually being back in time. And when I really thought about it, back in the early 70s, when I became a Mets fan, I was busy. I had to go to school. I had
Sure.
bedtime. I couldn't watch the night games. In
Sure.
summer, I was in camp. So I figure, I only ever watched like a couple of games a week. The rest of
Sure.
the time, I was reading about in the newspaper. I used to
All
read
right.
newspapers every morning when I was a kid. So in 2023, when I was systematically reading the newspapers one day at a time and never going ahead, I was actually having the same experience that I had
Wow.
in a lot of 1973.
I've never thought of anybody putting that way. Now I'm a little bit not your same generation. I'm in my late 40s, but similar to you growing up. Late 80s, post 86, really, when I started watching baseball, I did not have cable TV. So I was access to maybe at that point, you could still probably get 100 games. Obviously, curfews and bedtime, you're 12 years old, whatever it may be. And for me, it was newspapers, but also that was the advent of sports talk radio and WFAN. So listening to the game on the radio and things like that, actually, on a sports time traveler note, I just found. A clock radio. I mean, the thing stopped working. It was amazing. I had it because I for nostalgia, and all of a sudden it must have gotten, short circuited because it was just going on randomly. I thought my house was haunted, but no, it's this damn clock radio, and it was nostalgia because that's what I would use to listen to the ball game because you had so many ball games. And you bringing up, and I think it's an interesting way for those listening, they want to go back and enjoy history. And even if you weren't around or alive, I think. Reading about how the media covered the team, how the team was viewed, how players were viewed. It's actually quite an interesting experience because it's way different. Like you would, if the 73 Mets were playing in 23, I don't know if the media, and you tell me because you read the papers, I don't know if the coverage would be the same, in that point.
Well, the one thing that's different about the coverage is in these times where you can watch every game, you can see at least see highlights or clips on ESPN or social media. I think a lot of the news coverage is kind of after the fact. It's kind of filling in little things. Whereas back in 73, as I was mentioning, a lot of people, their full experience of the game was just that one, you know, newspaper article. And one of the interesting things that I've been able to do as the sports time traveler now is because I have access to all the newspaper archives, I don't just read one story about a game. I'll read like six or eight different stories about a game. And I'll read it in Newsday and the New York Daily News and the New York Times. But then I'll also read, you know, if they're playing the Reds, I would read the Cincinnati papers, get their perspective. And one of the most fascinating things when I was writing the stories that ended up being in the book is that sometimes when you piece together what one reporter said and what another reporter got an interview of a player, and you all of a sudden you get a story. And that's what I really try to do in the Sports Time Traveler, my newsletter, and most importantly in the book. The book consists not just of telling you about the games and what happened. It's actually 100 short stories. Now, each short story follows a game, but I only wrote a chapter in the book when there was something compelling to write about. And that's, to me, was the kind of the fascinating thing about this, finding all these really gems of stories along the way.
Did you have a different perspective on players or the team reading back? I always, for me, players that I thought were really good or, you know, indispensable as a kid, now in the age of analytics and the age of different deep dive and analysis, and actually work, you know, taking the emotion of the season and coming outside of yourself, you say, well, they could have done this. Maybe this was, I understand why they did that, or the manager played that. Or did you have any of that kind of experience writing the 1973 Mets?
Definitely. When I was a kid, I was a big Tom Seaver fan. Everybody who followed the Mets was Tom Seaver fans. But writing the book, I developed even greater an appreciation for Tom Seaver. And I'm really glad to hear that Netflix is actually going to do a documentary coming up on Tom Seaver.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's awesome to hear.
Just heard about that last week. Tom Seaver had the most incredible season in 1973. His statistics don't show it for two reasons. Number one, the Mets gave him such poor run support. And that Mets team in 73, they were famous for their pitching, and they were notorious for the depth, the dearth of hitting, just unbelievably poor.
Oh, I got the baseball reference page up here. Jeez, we would have a field day with analytics on this one.
So Seaver, it's amazing to me looking back how many 1-0, 2-0 games Seaver lost, and it was so frustrating. And he had an ERA that was down around only 1.7 very late in the season. And then Yogi Berra, in a go-for-broke strategy to try to win the division, decided to pitch Seaver on 3 days rest in September. And surprisingly, that didn't work. Seaver had some of his worst games of the whole season in September when they were making that drive, and Berra was pitching him on 3 days rest. And so his ERA ended up over 2 for the season. So you don't appreciate how great he was most of the season. And it's very interesting that, you know, Seaver played his heart out, but the Mets won the division in spite of Seaver having a few bad starts around the end of September. And then the other big narrative that's throughout the book is Willie Mays. You know, it's still surreal to me that the Mets got Willie Mays in 1972, and he finished out his career in New York. But very sadly, it became the almost a passion, it seems, of sports writers at the time to pursue the narrative that Willie Mays was washed up, and maybe he should have retired already. And he became the epitome of the great athlete who doesn't know when to hang up his spikes. But the more I read, the more I went back and followed all the newspaper articles, the more I noticed that Mays actually played pretty well. No, he wasn't Willie Mays circa 1954, making the catch in the Polo Grounds and winning the MVP. But he was the best center fielder on the Mets that year.
Yeah, for sure.
And he won several games with key hits, including Game 5 of the National League Championship Series and Game 2 of the World Series. Mays really played his heart out. And one thing that never came through at the time, but comes through now, and with statistics we have, is in 1972, Mays was second in the National League in on-base percentage at 400. I mean, that's just phenomenal. But nobody knew that at the time. All we knew was, well, he was hitting like 260.
Sure. You
know? And then and then in his last year, you know, every day the New York Times used to post the batting averages of all the players on the Mets. And Mays got off to a very difficult start in 73. It was cold. He had bad knees, so that didn't work for him in the cold. He hurt his shoulder. He had trouble swinging the bat. In June, and then he spent the first time in his whole career, he went on the disabled list because his shoulder was so bad. He couldn't even throw a ball back from the outfield, so they put him on the disabled list, missed a month. When he comes back, he has a little slump, and his average dips to 0.94. I mean, that's really
horrific, that's pretty bad
for anybody.
Yeah.
But then what got lost, totally lost, was partially because the newspapers used to report your season batting average every day, and the Mets were in last place, so nobody was noticing. But Willie goes through a resurgence, and he has a long stretch in the summer where he's batting over 300. But his base batting average for the season starts from such a low figure that he only ever gets to a little above 200, and he ends that season batting 211, but it's completely misleading. And in the summer months, when they were in last, there was a time where Willie Mays was carrying the team.
Yeah, Willie's interesting because, yes, he was 40 when he came in, 41, and he certainly did not have a historic campaign in 73. But 2 years earlier, he still had an OPS of 900. He didn't have the same power. He was declining his last years with the Giants. I mean, he's late 30s. And what we've noticed, and we've seen it here with, in particular, you know, maybe Max Scherzer a little bit, Tom Glavine at some point, JD Martinez maybe falls into that, where once Father Time hits that line with you as an athlete, you see the drop precipitous, where the competition becomes too fast and what have you. But to your point, Willie still was a contributor. And I think in today's day and age, I don't know how he would be viewed. Probably the fans would say he stinks, release him, get rid. 0.94 or hitting a buck, you know, 100. I mean, that's Robinson Cano territory from a couple of years ago. So it's interesting. But, you know, he is Willie Mays, and a veteran like that, there's the duality where his presence in the locker room, you know, the ability in a big spot to find that juice. Willie at least was able to do that, where sometimes you see these
absolutely.
Guys fall off the cliff. They can't even do that. Was he the best option as an everyday player? You and I know on a better team, he's probably a backup. Could Willie have been a backup on another team, not in New York? Who knows? But you're right. The coverage looking back is a little bit different than in the moment where, yeah, I was just looking at his numbers. In July and August, he was, you know, not elite, but serviceable as a component player. And the only difference is it's a component player when Willie Mays' name is attached to it. You don't think of that.
You also have to look at, you know, replacement players. And the Mets didn't have a major league center fielder. They were using Don Hahn. Don Hahn had a very short career, and he was really a triple-A type player, had no power. And Willie Mays was actually, when he was, the problem Willie Mays had that year was he was hurt the whole year. And a lot of his injuries were because he was being totally selfless. Like, the last regular season game he ever played was, I believe, on September 9th, 1973 in Montreal. And he's playing first base because his shoulder's so bad he can't make throws in from the outfield. There's a pop fly that goes near the Expos dugout. And Mays is just intent on catching the ball. And he runs at full speed and he slams into the iron bar in front of the Expos dugout. And actually cracked two ribs, and that's why he never played another game in the regular season. And then when he comes in to game five, unexpectedly, in a very important at bat situation, in game five, the deciding game in the best of five series against the Big Red Machine in the National League Championship Series, he's still got these two cracked ribs. They're not healed. They're only 4 weeks ago, and yet he hits what turns out to be the most important hit in the game, and the Mets break open the game and win that National League Championship Series that they had no right winning. This was the Big Red Machine at the height of their prowess, when they were the most hungry they could have been. They had lost the World Series in seven games the year before. And the Reds coming into that series had gone on one of the great runs in history. They had started the season slow in 73, and then the Reds went on a run of 60-26. That's like 110 win pace.
Sure.
And that's how they won the West. And they came into that Western Division, into that NLCS, intent on getting back to the World Series.
But what it does prove, and this is not something they probably talked about back then, is the small sample size randomness. And I'm not a data guy, but I mean, you got to look at the sport in that sense, where a team like the Mets, look, the Mets pitching, a couple of things that you brought up, and I think the fans need to understand this. First, 71 might be arguably Seaver's best season in a Mets uniform. I mean, I didn't even know about, because you read the papers, about the 3 days rest later in the year. He would have had an ERA plus over 200. I mean, we're talking Jacob deGrom. For the modern fan in that season, right? So Seaver has. The Mets as a staff were equally as good as any of the top teams in history. They're right there with an 86 Mets or the 2022 Mets that won 100 games. Or you name a good pitching Mets team, the 73 team had that. Now, their bullpen was shaky, and I think Tug McGraw was a shakier closer than what we, other than the Gotta Believe, well, I'm sure we'll get to that. It was this offense that, here you are trying to rely on a compromise and broken ribs from Willie Mays. Think about it. Anybody who's had that injury, I haven't, but I've heard. I mean, you can't breathe. You can't breathe. This is not like, okay, let me just rely on my strong side. No, you are in total pain. To be able to perform at that elite level tells you something about the commitment to the team. And in a lot of ways, I wasn't sure why they retired his number as a Met. I don't like when teams retire numbers for players that didn't play with them, but I heard about the Mrs. Payson promise. And then you hear you talk, and I'm like, here's a guy at 42 years old. I understand they weren't, $300 million contracts back then. He didn't have to do this. It was Willie Mays. He could have went and signed autographs and probably made as much money, right, at that point. So it is interesting that this is a team that had elite starting pitching, and it's not as surprising when you have that kind of staff, because in today's day and age, if I were Cincinnati, I'd be like, why would I want to face Seaver a couple of times? Why would I want to face Kuzman? These are guys that can neutralize them. And Cincinnati did not have great pitching. That's the thing. So there was an Achilles heel a little bit, despite Morgan and Rose and Perez and Bench and all these, historic offensive names that go down in history as some of the best of the best.
Now, actually, Cincinnati didn't have bad pitching. They weren't quite as good as the Mets staff.
Not Mets level, though. Let's put it that way.
Not Mets level. And then what the Mets did to Cincinnati in that National League Championship Series is nothing short of historic. The Mets held the big red machine to 8 runs in 5 games.
Years earlier, holding that Orioles team, and I don't think people realize, I know it's not 73 related, that Orioles team was really tough. I mean, up and down that lineup. So just to put in perspective how good the Mets pitching was, and I guess what would be frustrating looking back as a fan, and you had Rusty and you had Milner who were good, but they never were able to even get a couple of, not up and down the lineup. We don't want them to be the 27 Yankees or the 04 Red Sox or anything like that, but they weren't able to really leverage that pitching, finding those kind of offensive players. And it really is a shame, because who knows what the 69 to 74, 75 could have been if and I don't know if that came to mind as you're reading this and looking back.
Well, one thing that comes to mind, and I have a chapter about it, because I actually start the book in 1972. I start the book with the acquisition of Willie Mays. I thought that was a good starting point. And I also Excellent. Thought it was very important to honor Bill Hodges, who had passed away right before the start of the 72 season. I didn't feel like you could tell the story of the 73 Mets without talking about Gil Hodges and how Yogi Berra came to be the manager. So, but one of the things that came up as I'm following the 72 Mets is the New York Times reporter met with the California Angels general manager late in 1972. And the general manager told him, when we got Nolan Ryan, and when we traded Jim Fregosi for Nolan Ryan, which is the most infamous trade in the history of the New York Mets franchise, and that trade happened at the end of 1971. So here, a year later, the general manager is telling a reporter in the New York Times, I actually asked for Gary Gentry. And the Mets said no. So, and the Mets countered with Nolan Ryan. And I said, okay.
And Gentry wasn't chopped liver either. Remember that. It's not like, and he was a little bit more established. Just to be fair, he was a little bit more established at that point than Ryan.
Yes, he was. But in hindsight,
yes,
what a colossal mistake.
Could you imagine that rotation if Ryan stayed in, and he had to, there was no free agency up until the late 70s. Mm-hmm. Seaver, Ryan, Matlack, I mean, geez.
Unbelievable.
That might be the one of the best rotations in the history of the game. And Ryan, even to Anaheim, California back then, he still walked a lot of guys. He still needed seasoning. I don't think it was until the late 70s where he really, really put it together. But still, that would have been tremendous, just having him as like a fourth starter or something like that.
Oh, actually, he was tremendous already in 72 and 73. In 73, Ryan set the record for most strikeouts in a season, 383 in 1973.
Amazing.
So imagine Ryan on the Mets in 73.
Sure.
They most likely win the World Series. So I have a chapter in my book that I titled, I Asked for Gary Gentry, where I tell this story.
Oh, you're going to really listen. I mean, there are Mets fans listening to this right now that are pounding. And the key, you bring up Fregosi, because they played him a little bit at the hot corner earlier in the year before they got rid of him. Fregosi was a decent bat. He wasn't he wasn't at the level of, you know, maybe a Cleon Jones or the, but he was a really solid shortstop, on base guy, could hit for some power. If he had been able to produce, again, it wouldn't have justified the trade. I'm not saying that, but it really killed them not having that bat. That was the bat I think that they thought was going to help them compete and possibly win another title.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, they should have known that, because in 71. Fregosi had a terrible season with the California Angels. The Mets were counting on him returning to his form from 1963 to 1970, but what they got was the same guy that was in 1971. And then it turns out Wayne Garrett became their solution at third base. Wayne Garrett had the second most home runs on that 73 team. He had more home runs than Rusty Staub. And because Staub was actually injured most of the year also. Staub
and that hurt them later on. Sure, that shoulder injury hurt them later on.
And what really hurt them was it both endeared Staub to Mets fans forever, but hurt them in the World Series was in game four of the NLCS against the Reds. There was a long fly ball hit to deep right field, and Staub knew, you can just see it when you watch the tape, he knew the only way to catch the ball was he was going to have to crash into the wall. And he does this. He catches the ball and he crashes into the wall, and he hurt his shoulder so bad that Staub actually didn't play the decisive game five in the NLCS. And in the World Series, he was hurting so bad that in the first game of the series, there was a short fly hit the right field that he couldn't catch. When he gets the ball, he has to underhand flip it to Felix Mian, who came halfway out into right field to get it.
Sure.
That cost the Mets one and maybe two runs, and that was a close game. They could have possibly won game one if Staub had not been hurt.
Right, absolutely. It's a great book, the 1973 Mets, you got to believe in. And I know everybody's probably going to have books coming out about the 73 Mets. It's an under-talked about part of Mets history, but this one's different if you hear Len Furman joining us. And I had, during COVID, there was a book that came out about Yogi Berra. And part of that conversation here on a Mets-centric show is Yogi had a mixed tenure as a manager with the Mets. Obviously, you mentioned Gil and Gil passing, which was tragic. And maybe Mets history is different with Gil on many fronts. Whitey Herzog thought he was going to get the job. Would have been interesting if Whitey had gotten the job. And from what I understand, it was M. Donald Grant didn't like Whitey. Maybe you have some insight into that. And Yogi, you know, there's the World Series decision with Seaver on short rest. You brought up a little bit earlier. You know, were there other and Yogi wound up losing the clubhouse. And I remember the late, great Ed Cranepool maybe being iffy about Yogi as a manager. Not so much direct words. But what did you learn about Yogi? Baseball royalty as a Yankee. Mets brought him over. That's always a dicey proposition. Even back then, Mets fans don't like taking the Yankees fans' scraps unless the name is Juan Soto. So what did you learn a little bit about Yogi? Because sometimes looking back, he's blamed for the World Series loss.
I don't want to be all negative about Yogi. You know, obviously, Yogi had a tough tenure with the Mets. A lot of ups and downs. On the positive side, Yogi never gave up that year. And he kept saying in the press in August, I think we can still put it together. We're in last, but we're not that many games back. And he was still staying positive. He never packed it in. In fact, his famous malapropism, "It ain't over till it's over."
Yep.
It's funny. It comes. People say it comes from the 1973 season, but I just read an article about this recently that he never actually. Nobody can find where he actually said that in the 1973 season. I was wondering after I finished the book, I realized. After I did all the research, I realized I never came across that quote. And so I had to research and find, well, he didn't actually say it, but a lot of people attribute it to him. So, but he definitely had the spirit of that it's not over till it's over. So he wasn't giving up. You definitely have to fault him for the 3-day rest thing. And as you pointed out, it was game six of the 1973 World Series where the Mets went back to Oakland, leading the World Series 3-2.
Yep.
I remember as a Mets fan, I felt so good about that. We only have to win one more game.
Yeah.
Game six and seven are in Oakland. And then Berra has this monumental decision. Am I going to pitch Seaver on 3 days rest, or am I going to hold him out? And if we lose game six, then I'll have him for game seven on 4 days rest. And I have thought about this up and down, and I really can't fault Yogi Berra. And it's for this reason, or two reasons. Number one, he went to Seaver. He talked to Seaver, and Seaver said, "I'm ready to go. I want the ball." Now think about this. Seaver's your franchise pitcher. He's a superstar. He's arguably the best starting pitcher in baseball. The best starting pitcher in baseball says, "I want to go out and win the World Series." Do you tell him no? I'm holding you out for game seven.
No.
And
no.
Then even if you said, "Tom, sorry, I just want you to have one more day's rest. We'll use you in game seven." That would have meant you're going to bypass John Matlack, because Matlack was at that point in time, at that moment, Matlack was actually the best pitcher in the world, because Matlack had done something unbelievable. Matlack had not let up a single earned run in the playoffs or the World Series against the Reds and the A's.
Amazing. Against that elite offense, it's amazing. Elite.
And so how do you, if you say, "I'm going to pitch the fourth starter, we have George Stone, nice pitcher, but who's George Stone? He didn't have much of a career." If you say you're going to pitch George Stone in game six and Seaver in game seven, it means you're not going to give Matlack another chance when the guy hasn't let up a single earned run. So, I actually think if Matlack hadn't performed so well, then the decision would have been much easier for Yogi. To say, okay, I'm going to pitch the fourth starter. I've got a game I can lose, and I'll have my best guy in game seven. But, Seaver's telling you he wants to go. You've got Matlack for game seven.
Yeah, Seaver's going to call his own shot. Yeah.
But what happened is both of those guys were coming in on 3 days rest, and they were both tired. And the ace players saw the difference. One of the fascinating things about the book is I had a lot of access to talk to Ted Kubiak of the Oakland A's.
And, very solid, by the way, solid defensive shortstop. Not a great hitter, but typical for that 70s era. Good defense and a contact bat, I would say, was good.
Yeah, well, Ted, Tony La Russa has said that Ted Kubiak was the most valuable player on those 3A's championship teams because Ted could play second, short, or third.
And play
and
well.
Frequently had to do it and come in, and they wouldn't miss a beat. And a lot of sports writers at the time said that Ted Kubiak was the best best infielder in the American League. And by the way, he's published a book recently on how to field a ground ball, and he's coming out with another one targeted at kids. I think any kid or high school or even minor league player that really wants to be a great infielder needs to read Ted Kubiak's
book. They can
book.
Learn a lot from 1970s fundamental baseball. It wasn't the sexiest era of numbers, but some real good, solid baseball for sure. Yeah,
I just wanted to finish up this point. So Ted had given me a lot of insights about how when they went back to Oakland and they were on their home field and they felt comfortable again, and these Mets arms were a little tired, he just knew they were going to win. And Ted lined me up to talk to Gene Tennis, who was the 1972 American League MVP, and he was also on that 73 team. Pennis said something absolutely fascinating that I had never seen anywhere else. He said in game seven, the A's players were sitting in the dugout, and they said, George Stone, the fourth starter, he had pitched just a couple of innings in relief during the series and never got a start because they only started Seaver, Kuzman, and Matlack for the seven games. But Gene Tennis said the players were sitting in the dugout when they saw Matlack was tired, saying, "Why aren't they pitching this guy Stone? We can't hit him." Because Stone had actually pitched well in his brief appearances. So I thought that was fascinating, that that perspective also, that while the Mets' big starters were tired, the A's were sitting there thankful that the Mets weren't pitching George Stone.
And that has come up. And here's, and again, I'm sure there are Mets fans listening to Len right now going, it's like me with the 88 with Socha's home run or 99. Like, you look back and I remember during COVID, I was watching game one of the 2000 World Series, and I'm like, I'm hoping for the outcome to change. It's insanity. It doesn't. But I'm reading. So everybody blames the Yogi decision. You're right. Seaver pitched well in game six. It was the offense that let them down. And even further, Catfish Hunter comes out in the eighth inning. This is the Mets shot. One out, Boswell with a single, Garrett with a single, runners at the corners, Felix Mian, very underrated, good hitter, base hit, runners at the corners, one out, one run down. You have Rusty and Cleon Jones. Now, Cleon wasn't 1969 Cleon, but you have your best hitter, understand he's compromised. All you need is a fly ball to tie the ball game. Rusty strikes out, Cleon then flies out. Well, if only they could have flipped it around. There's your series. See, if you're looking at it as an objective person, if we were doing our goofy post-game shows on X and Twitter spaces like we did during this past postseason, I know the fans would call and go, there was our shot to win a championship. And that was when it went in. Yeah. Yes, Stone, and Game 7 is a flip of the coin game anyway. Matlack was so good, he was bound to get hit. Long series, things kind of settle into where the right players perform in the right way because you've seen them so many times. That one hurt. I don't know if you watched that one on replay.
I actually have a whole page in my book on Rusty Staub's at bat that you were just talking about. And I include in the coverage of the World Series, I include links to all the games. You can watch all the games on YouTube. And I break down that Rusty Staub at bat. The camera work was fantastic on that Rusty Staub at bat. You can actually see on Rusty's face that he is thinking, I'm going to hit a home run and we're going to win the World Series. Because if he hits a home run right there, it puts the Mets ahead. And they're going to bring in Tug McGraw. They're going to win the World Series. Right. And it's funny, after the game, Staub said, in the newspapers, at least the reporters quoted him as saying, all I was trying to do was, you know, meet the ball. But it's very apparent when you watch it. He makes three gargantuan swings. And I've watched
all
it
he
over
had to do was meet
again.
The ball. And you're just meet the ball. Well, Rusty was a line drive, a solid lefty line drive hitter. That's what they needed. But in a lineup that is shallow, I mean, look at who got the hits, Boyer and Garrett. I mean, Garrett was okay, but Boyer wasn't a great hitter. You kind of got to make it happen with your big guys, because who else were you going to go to? I mean, that's the unfortunate part of a lineup that really was only two or three deep. I mean, you had three shots a game, you know, and I remember as a kid, my dad used to say, the old Mets, it was like you had three shots a game because they only had three hitters. So if you didn't take advantage of those three shots, you know, you were done. That one hurts. I'm sure you had the same reaction because I wasn't alive for 73. Me watching the 2000 game one of the World Series, you might have the same reaction watching that Rusty at bat on YouTube on replay. And by the way, I've watched some clips watching the 73 series where television was just starting to have nighttime, I think, evolving as a product. Those were some really good commentary. I think Cosell might have been one of the announcers. Am I right on that?
It was Kurt Gowdy. Kurt Gowdy was the lead announcer. And then what was really fascinating was they would bring in for the home, whichever team was at home, they had that team's main lead by play-by-play announcer be the color announcer. So in the three games in Shea Stadium in that 1973 World Series, you had Kurt Gowdy for NBC, And you had Lindsey Nelson.
Lindsey Nelson, right?
Calling the game. And I loved that because Lindsey Nelson, he was like, I thought of Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, and Ralph Kiner, the three Mets play-by-play announcers. I thought of them as like my uncles. I spent so much time listening to them. So I loved having hearing Lindsey Nelson on the color. And then I forget who the A's play-by-play announcer was, but he did games 1, 2, 6, and 7 on NBC.
I mean, classic good baseball announcing. And I haven't watched the full game. I've watched spurts of it. And we could learn a lot today. We were very lucky as those who follow the Mets with what the Mets have in their booth. But just know that's not what usually happens across the sport. And that's legendary, hardcore, old school, really good play-by-play announcing. Makes it much more enjoyable to watch those games, for sure.
I want to bring up one more Yogi Berra decision. And it's really hard to second guess 50 years later. But in game 7, with 2 outs in the top of the 9th, Mets are down 5-2. They're down, obviously, to their last batter. And the A's have a lefty pitcher in Darryl Knowles. Darryl Knowles, by the way, pitched in all 7 games of the World Series. First player ever to do that. The Mets have Wayne Garrett, a lefty, coming to the plate. Knowles is a lefty pitcher. And you've got 2 runners on. A home run ties the game.
Yep.
The Mets had Willie Mays, a right-handed batter, on the bench. Willie Mays is the 3rd leading all-time home run hitter. Mays had come through with the winning hit in game 2 of the World Series. And Berra, after game 2, Berra, because Willie had, I have a chapter, the chapter for game 2 of the World Series, I titled it The Last Heroics and Hiccups of Willie Mays, because he did some great things and he had some hiccups. He fell down running the base pads. He lost a ball in the sun in the outfield. But by the way, Reggie Jackson had also lost a ball in the sun in the outfield, and nobody said he was washed up. But I say in the book, there's a form of diagnosing or doing psychoanalysis could be when you watch game 2 of the 1973 World Series, did you focus on the heroics or the hiccups of Willie Mays? I focused on the heroics, but Yogi Berra focused on the hiccups and banished Mays to the bench for the rest of the series.
Is it because he got thrown at? I mean, he didn't get thrown at the plate. He was there. I mean, they were safe. That's a whole nother story. The play.
Earlier in game 2, in the 10th inning, Bud Harrelson is thrown out at the plate.
Willie on deck.
And
right?
Willie Mays is on deck. So Willie's got the best view of that play. And Harrelson's throwing out, that would have been the go-ahead run in the 10th inning. It became a moot point because the Mets won the series.
The Mets won
that game anyway. But what happens is Willie is standing right there. He sees that there's no way that the catcher, Ray Fossey, made the tag on Harrelson. There's just no way that he did. And the ump didn't actually have as great a view either as Willie Mays. So Willie Mays, in one of the greatest images, I think, in really the history of sports, you have Mays. And you can Google these pictures. If you Google Willie Mays game 2, 1973 World Series, you'll see the pictures where he's on his knees. His arms are up in the air and he's pleading with the umpire to overturn the call. And think about this. When have you ever seen an athlete of that stature willing to put himself in that position, knowing he's on the world stage and cameras are on him and he's on his knees begging? So this is a guy who, I like to describe Willie Mays as selfless. He was doing everything he could for the team. And that's
he wanted a championship. Moment. He wanted to win a championship, wanted to finish his career in New York. And you got a guy like that laying it all on the line. I mean, we didn't hear a lot from Willie post playing career all the time. You know, he had some other things that maybe got him a little jaded about the media, but you know, you're bringing to life a side of Willie with the Mets, particularly, that I don't think people talk about. I think it's important. And I think another name, and I'd be remiss if we didn't bring him up, because historically the Mets always have closers that give you agita. Let's face it. Even Edwin Diaz, who might be the best all time coming out in the 9th inning. Tug McGraw was no exception. Tug McGraw was one of those guys that was good against righties, not so much against lefties. And the perception I have, again, you read it, you watched it, you lived it, is that you never felt any lead was safe with Tug. Now, he's older, you got to believe in the energy and the enthusiasm. But Tug was not as lights out as you probably would want. It was interesting because you brought up that eighth inning in Oakland. I don't have to bring it up. Was Seaver still in the game? Would they have come back out with Seaver? Or was Seaver gone already? Because Tug was no sure thing if the Mets had taken the lead to get the save. He was a little kerosene on a fire over there.
Actually, Tug down the stretch was as responsible as anybody for the Mets making that rise from last to first. And he actually was having a really terrible season. His ERA in the middle of the season actually went over six. But come the end of August and into September, he went into lockdown mode. His ERA, I'd have to look it up, but it was well under one for the entire last month of the season. And the Mets finished the season on a 24-9 run. And McGraw either saved or won most of those games. I forget the exact number. It might be like 20 of the 24. McGraw either got the save or the win. And so he was actually pitching fantastic down the stretch that year. He had been, I'd say from 69 to 72, he was arguably the best relief pitcher in baseball. But then he went through this terrible stretch in most of 73. And then when they're in last place, he comes up with that "you gotta believe" mantra. He had been working with a mental health coach, and he had sold him on this idea of "you gotta believe." So he started chanting it. There was a locker room meeting. You know, they're in last place, so they had a locker room meeting with the GM one day in late July, and the GM's talking very seriously to the team. And McGraw, you know, he pitched a screwball, and he was a little bit of a screwball himself.
Lefty.
He talks about how he used to fall asleep in the bullpen, and he used to bring spare ribs from his car into the bullpen, and so he got bored listening to the GM, and he just started screaming, "You gotta believe!"
The GM
thought he was mocking him, but McGraw was really just trying to get people fired up. That's what he was doing. And the GM never forgave him for it. And after the 74 season, when McGraw had a very mediocre season, he dumped him. And as a Mets fan, I never forgave them for that, because I mean, here you're only 1 year out from that "you gotta believe" season, and you get rid of him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. A couple of things before we wrap up. This was really the end of an era. They lose game seven. And they were competitive for a little bit before the disaster and then the ownership change and the rebuild. But this was almost the end of that 4 year period where you felt the Mets could win or repeat 69. Did you see it that way? Looking back, it was kind of like a bit of a coup de grace for that group.
Definitely, they lost over 90 games the next year, and they just weren't competitive at all. The funny thing is, my perspective growing up, I became a Mets fan in 1970 when I was 6 years old. I missed 69 because I was just too
you're
young.
Like, you're like me. You don't can't too young to appreciate the good year, you know, so you're still searching, right?
So my perspective growing up was 69. That was ancient history. I didn't know anything about it. I see it in record books, but my experience, 70, 71, 72, and until the end of August of 73, we were a very mediocre team. 70, 71, they win 83 games. I think 70, 71 and 72, they win 83 games. So, you know, fair, but never really competing. The Pittsburgh Pirates were always way out in front in the division, and they had, you know, superstar hitters. That we were not competing with them. So it really, from my perspective growing up, it wasn't until September 1973 that we did anything worthy of getting excited about. Sure. And then 74, you know, they fall off a cliff, losing 91 games. And I'll tell you, the interesting thing is, what's the one big difference between the 73 and the 74 season? They still have Seaver, Kuzma, Matlack, McGraw. They still have Rusty Staub, Wayne Garrett, Jerry Grody, Bud Harrelson. Who don't they have? Willie Mays.
Willie Mays isn't part of the team.
Willie Mays is not in the locker room there and not providing a little bit of assistance. And, you know, there's no other way to look at that than say Willie Mays, you know, that's really the epitome of how important a player is. If you take him away, what happens when he's not there and everything else is the same?
Yeah, it's amazing. I think you brought up some things that we didn't hear before about the Gentry trade and everything. But in any project, did you go in with something or learn something coming out that was surprised you? I mean, was there anything? Because anytime you take on something like this, yeah, you lived it. You were young. But I always like to ask someone, like, what did you learn? Something that really, like, wow. Or, you know, if you choose to share that.
Well, I've had a lot of wow moments.
Yeah. Are you giving us a couple on this? You're hurting Mets fans, that knife about that eighth inning.
Yeah. And as the sports time traveler covering other things, there's so many things I've uncovered that are really just absolutely fascinating. But I think one of the things from 73 that I never knew about, that only because I struck up this friendship with Ted Kubiak did I find out, is in the book, I talk about what are the top four plays that cost the Mets the World Series in 1973. One of them is what we talked about earlier, the Rusty Staub strikeout in Game 8. But my number one was actually related to Ted Kubiak. Ted Kubiak scored the winning run in the 11th or 12th inning. It was an extra inning game, Game 3. Seaver had started that game, and the A's win it in extra innings because Ted Kubiak made a heads-up running play and scored from second base on a short outfield hit by Burke Campanaris. If Kubiak doesn't make that heads-up play and score that run, it was a heads-up play because, as Ted described it, all his training, he said, growing up and in the minor leagues, was you have to always know where everybody is on the field. And this is one of the things in his books. You've got to spend a lot of time always being conscious. Where is everybody and what is everybody's tendencies? So when Campanaris was at bat and Ted's on second base, he knew where the outfielders were. So he looks to see where the outfielders are because he wants to know if Campanaris hits a ball into the outfield, is an outfielder going to be able to catch it? There was still only one out. Is an outfielder going to be able to catch it, or is it going to fall in? And when Campanaris hit a line drive into left field, Kubiak knew instantly, nobody's catching that ball. I'm going home. And he said he didn't even look to see the third base coach wave him in. He knew he was going home, and he just barely touched home plate before Campanaris. You know, Campanaris was one of the fastest guys in the American League, so he tried to turn a single into a double, and Campanaris was thrown out at second. Kubiak scores just a second, like less than a second, before Campanaris touches second base. Now, if Campanaris gets thrown out at second, Kubiak's run is not going to count.
Doesn't count. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, there were two outs. There were two outs when Campanaris hit the ball. If Campanaris is thrown out at second, that's the end of the inning. Kubiak's run doesn't score. And I would contend they don't win Game 3 because the A's had used up most of their players. The Mets still had a whole bunch of players on the bench. And so the longer the game went,
the Mets are
playing in Shea, the longer the game goes, the more it favors the Mets. And here's the thing. If the Mets win Game 3, that puts them up 2-1. And what happened in Games 4 and 5 is Matlack and Kuzman completely shut down the A's. Matlack didn't give up an earned run. And I can't remember if Kuzman actually pitched a shutout, but I don't think either of them let up an earned run. The Mets would have won the series 4-1, just like they did in 69, if Kubiak doesn't score that run. And I think that was the actually most consequential play in the World Series. And, I've never heard anybody talk about that.
You're right. They didn't score an earned run, the A's, in those two games. They scored a run. It was unearned. They didn't score a single run. And you lose two Seaver starts. That's really hard. The fact that they got to 7, losing two Seaver starts, that's the killer. Best season in Seaver's career, arguably. And you lose those two. It really is a team, and you have to wonder, they win that championship, that's 2 in 4 years. What does that mean going forward? Is there a course of Mets history that changes? Hard to say. They might have still lost 90 games next year. It was kind of a last-minute throw it together. You know, really, if someone had run away with the division that season, they never would have been in the race. I mean, nobody wanted the division. Basically, everyone looked at each other and said, you're going to take it? You're going to take it? No, I'll take it. You guys don't want it. Because you had Pittsburgh that was a solid team. Chicago still, I mean, nobody had a good record. I think the Phillies were the only team that weren't really that good. Right. But even
the Phillies were only four games out late in August.
Right. Yeah.
One thing I want to point out, and this was another thing that I didn't appreciate or maybe didn't understand at the time, was that Mets miracle finish there and winning the division. It wouldn't have been possible unless the tragedy, if the tragedy of Roberto Clemente perishing in a plane crash while he's trying to personally deliver humanitarian aid.
Yep. Yeah, at the height of his career
in Nicaragua. You know, he had been the World Series MVP in 1971, and he had a very good year in 72. And if he doesn't perish, I'm certain the Pirates win that division.
They had a good offense.
They had a great offense, and the Pirates were in a haze. They had just lost, you know, one of the greatest players, maybe the greatest right fielder in history.
Sure.
And also something I absolutely didn't know at the time. In a game against the Mets in early August, when St. Louis was in first place, Bob Gibson suffered a terrible knee injury and missed almost the entire rest of the season. And Gibson was pitching well. The Cardinals were in first. If Gibson doesn't hurt his knee in that Mets game, the Cardinals who finished second probably win the division.
So wow. It's amazing.
Mets snuck in there because a couple of key players from the other teams weren't there.
Well, Len, this has been an awesome segment. I mean, we've gone back and done books and done different types of lookbacks, but the fact that what you do, looking at the newspapers, really diving into it, getting Ted Kubiak and Gene Tennis to give perspective, awesome stuff. The Sports Time Traveler is a podcast. It's a website. It's a Substack. It's obviously a newsletter, like Talking Mets. What's coming up, Mets or otherwise? Any interesting things you want to tease, projects? Let the listeners know where they could find you, because I suspect after hearing you do 1973, I want to like say, hey, man, what's your next? Like, is there NBA stuff? Is there hockey stuff? Mm-hmm. Is there baseball, more Mets stuff? Even if it's not Mets, maybe things pertinent to New York fans. Obviously, we're biased there here at this show. So let us know a little bit about what's coming up, and we'd love to have you on if you do some more Mets stuff, because I'm sure it'll be great like this.
I'll be doing Mets stuff, but it won't be very quickly, because 1975 was not a good year for the Mets. What I do in the Sports Time Traveler is I go back precisely 50, 60, 70 years. So always a specific decade. When I open the newspaper every morning, if it's January 5th, I'm reading the January 5th, 1975 paper to January 5th, 1965 paper, you know, et cetera, looking for stories. And in my Facebook page, I have a website, The Sports Time Traveler, and you can access my Substack and my Facebook page there. And in my Facebook page, I just posted a couple of weeks ago looking for fan input. Where do you want to see The Sports Time Traveler go? And I mentioned the things that I am looking at. So one of the things I'm definitely going to follow in 2025 is I'm going to go back 70 years each day. And I'm going to follow the 1955 Brooklyn Dodgers season.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah. Here's a spoiler alert. That's going to be the Dodgers' first World Series title.
Yeah, maybe you're not going to be able to avoid the information. Like, you know, when you record something, you don't want people to tell you the score. You're not going to be able to avoid 1955 at this point. So,
you know, the Dodgers lost to the Yankees in the World Series in 41, 47, 49, 52, 53. Yep.
Awesome.
I can't imagine how frustrating it was as a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. So I think it'd be very interesting to follow them in that 1955 season. I'm also going to be following the 1955 season of the, this is related to New York, the Syracuse Nationals basketball team. They won the
early days of the NBA. Yeah, look at that.
They had a star player who doesn't get enough recognition named Dolph Shays.
And his son, I remember his son played.
Yeah, Danny Shays played almost 20 years in the NBA. So Dolph Shays was one of the greatest players in the history of the NBA, but he's completely forgotten. Before Wilt Chamberlain, the all-time leading scorer in the NBA was Dolph Shays.
Amazing.
And 1955 was his one championship year. So I don't know anything about it other than they win the championship. So I'm very curious to follow that.
Awesome. Well, listen, Len, this has been a pleasure. Can't wait for the fan feedback. Could they follow you on X, Facebook? Is there any place that they could follow you that you want them to?
Best place to follow is Facebook.
Facebook,
or just subscribe to the Substack.
The Substack, and obviously you and I will keep in touch. Thanks so much. Generous of your time. I kept you a lot longer than we had talked about, but when the conversation's good with good people, I always think it's time worth well spent. So thanks so much, my friend.
Thank you so much. It was great being here.
All right, we're back. Final thoughts. Want to thank Len Furman for a great segment. Hope you enjoyed it. And look, throughout the season, whether it be movie night, we haven't done one of those in a long time, or a look back on Mets history. I know that we have our Hall of Fame show coming up in a couple of weeks. And obviously with David Wright's number being retired this year, we'll have definitely some look backs at that Mets era. I think the 04, 05, 06, 07 Mets, or the Wright-Reyes era Mets, have been put in the closet and not really talked about because it was such a negative period in some ways. And, you know, that might be some history that might come back up as we get further and further away from the 06, 07 collapse and some of the things there. But I really thought, again, it's kind of jammed in here in the middle of the hot stove. I thought it was a perfect day. I wanted to do this segment. Len had reached out to me a couple of weeks ago. And when we talked this morning, I said, you know, let me see where the news cycle goes today. And, you know, knowing how it was still pretty quiet on the baseball front, I said, why not let's just take a step back, take a blow, and look back at Mets history and enjoy some Mets baseball talk away from the AAV, free agency, building up the bullpen, all the stuff that's important and is going to be a big part of the conversation. And again, it's amazing. We're only about 5 or 6 weeks from pitchers and catchers and a little over 2 months away. I think the season starts middle of March with, what, a Korean series or something? So I don't have the schedule in front of me. But in about 60 days, you're going to have spring training games. And teams, I know the Mets roster is not complete, and a number of big free agents are still out there. So I think you'll start to see some things move this week, and I'm sure we'll either have special edition shows or we'll be back to the 2025 Mets. So weird saying 2025. We have plenty of time to talk about the current roster. So I hope you enjoyed this segment. Sports Time Traveler, I think it's a fascinating website, an interesting Substack, an interesting project. I really look forward to his 1955 Dodgers project, even though I'm a Mets fan, obviously growing up in Brooklyn, and the Mets having ties to both the Dodgers and the Giants. I have an affinity for those teams, especially the Brooklyn Dodgers. I think there are some of the audience that may feel the same way. Even though we don't like the current edition of the Dodgers, I call them the LA Private Equities, but that's another story for another day. And look, it's always good to get new contributors to the show, different resources and tools in an era where we really need more and more independent, non-mainstream journalism and content creation, because quite honestly, I don't think we get enough of it or good content creation at the professional level. So having Len Furman join the show and be a part of it, really appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll catch up again. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And I'd love for you to subscribe to the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Happy New Year. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. I'm sure there'll be some news. Keep going to the newsletter for the latest and greatest. Till then, take care, everybody.